We're doing the book of Yoshua. We're up to what the Christians call the seventh chapter. Last week we learned about how the Jewish people went to war against the city of Ai. They lost the war. Yoshua cries. Hashem tells him, get up. It's your fault to let you send them out to war without leading them to war. Hashem describes it as though all of Israel sinned, even though really we're going to see it was one person who sinned and other people turned a blind eye. We discussed last week the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the story of Rebbe and the student who ate garlic, and Rabbi Chiya walked out and everyone else walked out. We saw the story of Shmuel HaKotan, who said, I'm the extra student who came uninvited. We saw the story of Rabbi Meir and the student who had visited the woman of ill repute, and then Rabbi Meir went and wrote a get so as not to embarrass the one who was caught. And each time we moved up a generation, and each time the Talmud said he learned it from him, and he learned it from him, he learned it from him, until finally we say it was learned from God. That when Yeshua asked Hashem, who's the one that stole? So Hashem said, am I a tattletale? Am I going to be your snitch? No, you find out. Go draw lots. Go do it through the Urim and Thummim and find out. And so they do that, and the one that's caught is a man by the name of Achan. Achan means snake. And Achan is from the tribe of Yehuda. And Achan starts cursing, and he says, what are the lots worth? If you just put into a hat your name and Lazar, the high priest's name, and draw a lot, one of you is going to come out, so a lot doesn't prove anything. A lot just proves you had to pick out a name, so someone's name had to come out. Does that prove I did anything? And Yoshua says, please, honor God and honor the lot, because we're going to use lots to divide the territories. So he tells him, please confess, don't hide it. And Achan sees that civil war is about to erupt, that his tribe is standing up to protect him, and they're drawing their arms, and he realizes that this isn't what he wants. And so Achan confesses. And from here we learn that before a person gets a death penalty, in any instance, we invite them to confess, because through confession, they're not confessing to us. A confession to us is not the point. The point is a person should confess before his creator. He should say, you know, I regret what I did wrong. You don't need a rabbi present when a person confesses before a person dies. A person is supposed to say, I regret what I did wrong in life. I accept that Hashem is God of the world, and that let my death be an atonement for all that I did wrong. That's a confession. He doesn't have to say that you don't need a rabbi. We have more details written out in Sidurim, but that's the general gist of things. There was a story 2 years ago. A man was in a fatal car accident, and that Atzala member came, and he saw he wasn't going to make it. So he sat with the person, and the person said, just say vidu with me. Help me say what I should. And basically, this is what a person has to say before they pass away. I regret what I did wrong, and let my death be an atonement for what I did wrong. We also say Shema, we accept that Hashem is king of the world, etc. But that the confession is basically that. So Achan confesses that he stole not only this time. Previous times that we dedicated the loot to God, he also stole. And Yoshua right away sends messengers to his tent, and they take out of the tent, they find exactly where he says he hid it, and the reason we're so quick to do it is because they were scared that his tribe would try to hide the evidence. Achan is executed. Everyone stands witness. They put a huge pile of stones over him. And Yoshua declares, let you be cursed in this world, where Yoshua reveals that Achan has a portion in the world to come. It's only in this world that he's cursed. When a person confesses his sins before he's executed by the courts, so then his death is an atonement and they merit the world to come. Yeah?
If he stole previous occasions, why was I the first battle that they lost?
Excellent question. So we are taught, Hashem says that we only gain mutual responsibility when we enter the land of Israel. And so this was the first time we entered the land of Israel, and he stole, and other people knew it, and they turned a blind eye. So that was the mutual responsibility, and that's why we paid the price. So, Achan, that is the Rashi Tevos, the acronym, Al Kein Nekaveh Lecha Hashem Elokeinu. Achan compiled that chapter. Al-Kain as a standalone. Al-Kain, what does it mean? Therefore, our hope is in you, Hashem. Why? The whole chapter is based on therefore. We, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, we know that all the idol worshippers are going to be wiped out and everyone's going to recognize why. What's the punchline of Al-Kain Nekaveh? Ki ha-malchut shel chahi, because yours is the real kingship. So that's the declaration of Al-Kain Nekaveh. Who compiled Aleinu, the first paragraph? Yeshua. He hid his name in Aleinu. He hid it. It's spelled backwards. Aleinu is the Ayin, Shehem Mishtachavim is the Shin, Va'anachnu Korimu Mishtachavim is the Vav.
It's not arrogant.
Why? Why is it arrogant?
Oh, let's put your name, like, I compiled this, here's my name.
Quite the contrary, he hid his name. The Medrash says, in the end of the Torah, the Medrash says, Hashem said to Moshe, stick your name into the Torah. Every author should write his name on his work. People want to know who wrote it. Moshe said, me? But it's your Torah, I can't write my name in. So Hashem said, no, your name is going to be in there. And that's why in Ha'azinu, Ha'azinu, Hashem, Adbev, Shema, Adzim, Refi, the Ha'azinu is broken up into also chapters that are the heading of Moshe's name spelt backwards, where the Hey of Ha'azinu is the first. So we have a Medrash that Hashem insisted. Once Hashem told Moshe, your name has to be there, so then Moshe Rabbeinu said, okay, if Hashem says so, then it has to be there. So then in Tehillim, Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos is also Moshe's name, but he didn't want it to be overtly recognizable that he did it, so he stuck in the L'Yom. Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos. Really, it's Mizmor Shir HaShabbos. Why did he stick in L'Yom HaShabbos? So you shouldn't see the acronym. It's really Moshe with the Lamed stuck inside, so you shouldn't... What? Moshe? Yeah, it's part of Tefillah of Moshe. It's part of the prayer of Moshe that Moshe compiled, yeah.
Is Al-Kain Nekaveh the first paragraph of Aleinu? Or
it's the second paragraph, but Yeshua made an adjunct to it. Yeshua, once Achan compiled Al-Kain Nekaveh, Yeshua added Aleinu. Now really, Yeshua compiled Aleinu when we entered the land of Israel. When he looked around and saw all the pagans, and he realized, what's going on here? We have such a gift. The 40 years we were in the clouds, literally. Now he enters the land of Israel. He sees people burning their children for idols. He sees what a worthless life these pagans have. So he bows down and he compiles one of the holiest prayers we have, the prayer of Aleinu. He compiles that out of sheer thanks and appreciation that we are monotheists, that we adhere to the Torah. And that's really what Aleinu is.
When did we say it? When did the Jews say it?
Aleinu? I don't know. I don't know when it started being a part of prayer. I don't know. So Achan passes away. And Hashem tells Yeshua, don't worry. Take everyone. Go and attack Ai. So we set up an ambush. And Hashem tells Yeshua, who asked you to dedicate the loot of Jericho? Go enjoy the loot of Ai. And so Yeshua sets up one ambush, 30,000 men. He sends them out at night. And they're prepared. And Yeshua says, we'll attack and then we'll run and they'll give chase. And then you'll enter the city and destroy it and burn it. And when I see it burned, so we'll know to turn around and attack you. And attack the people of Ai. And then Yeshua sets up another ambush, 5,000 men, and he sets them up on another side. They go to attack. The people of Ai think that they're winning, so Yeshua and his men run away, and the people of Ai give chase. They leave the city. No one's left in the city. No man is left in the city. And so Yeshua raises his spear, which is the sign, and the ambush... they run into the city and they conquer the city, they turn it on fire, and then the people of Ai turn around and they see pillars of smoke coming out of their city, and they don't know where to run. Where are they going to run? Back into the city. They realize the city's been taken. So they run out, the Yeshua and the people turn around and they start giving chase and they destroy the people of Ai. And the ambush comes out from the city and there's nothing left. They capture the king of Ai alive. And the people come back, they destroy the city of Ai, 12,000 men, and
it's a small city.
It's a small city, right.
Wow.
They loot the city.
Wasn't small for that time also?
Yeah. That's why they thought they'd conquer it with a small army. That's why the first time they didn't trouble sending everyone. They hung the king of Ai on a tree, and when nightfall came, they took him down. And again, as a sign, they made a pile of stones on the king that was there for a long time. Then the Navi tells us the story of Yoshua building the altar by Mount Eval, and we discussed it earlier. And he writes the Torah in 70 languages. From then, we're allowed to teach the written Torah to non-Jewish people. Originally, we couldn't teach them the written Torah or the oral Torah, but once it was made available to them, because at the entrance to the land of Israel, you had the Torah translated to 70 languages, so that ever since then, we're allowed to teach the written Torah to the nations of the world. So we have the whole procession, as we discussed already, the blessings, the curses on Mount Gerizim and Mount Eval. Now, when the nations of Israel hear that we've entered and that we've started conquering the land, so they get together, they unify, and they're getting ready to fight us. They say, it's a live or die situation. Now, before Yoshua entered the land of Israel, before he started conquering the land of Israel, he sent a letter. And he told the people, you have three choices. You want? You could leave. You could leave peacefully. You want? You could stay and become Noahites. You want? You could fight and die. What's your choice? And the nations together decided we're fighting. There was one people, the people of Givon, they didn't want to fight. Their elders told them, you don't stand a chance. Here's what you should do. Go to Joshua, tell him you come from a faraway land, you heard about how great God is, and you want to become a part of the Jewish people, get them to make a pact with you, and then join them. So, they come to Joshua with worn clothing, and moldy bread, and moldy wine, and they come and they say, we come from a faraway land, we heard all about you, our elders said we should come and join you, so promise us, make a pact. And so the elders, the Nesim, they make a pact with them, and shortly afterwards, they discovered that they'd been duped. So technically, they didn't owe him anything, because when you make a deal, and the deal is predicated on false facts, you don't have to keep that deal. But in this case, if they would renege on the deal, then the nations, what would they hear? What would they publicize in the New York Times? They would say, the people of Israel are unfaithful people. They promised they would take care of the people of Givon, and then they turned like traitors on them, and they fought them. They wouldn't publicize the people of Givon lied to them and cheated them and tricked them and the whole pact was based on false assumptions. Look at what they say about the Oslo Accords. Israel isn't keeping their end of the deal. Really, we kept our end of the deal and they kept breaking their end of the deal. And so on and so forth. The Y Accords, the roadmap to peace. No one ever bothers discussing how they're reneging on their side. No. But everyone talks about how we renege on ours. So to prevent Chilul Hashem, they decide they're going to keep their pact, but they designate them that they should be the water drawers and the woodcutters for the altar. And that's why they were called Nitinim, those that were placed. The Givonim, later on, are called the Nitinim in the Mishnah and the Gemara, because they were placed with this responsibility, to cut wood and draw water. Now, later on, two things happen. So, firstly, the rest of the people choose to attack the Givonim. They say, why'd you break forces with us? You went and made a pact with the Jews, so they go to attack. And Joshua, the Givonim, send word to Joshua, don't leave us alone to get defeated. And Joshua combines the army and goes to fight, and fights for them. And Joshua says to God, why should I fight for them? They lied, they cheated, let them die. What do I have to fight for them for? God said, Yoshua, I like people who want to come close to Judaism. If you turn your back on those who want to come close, you will ultimately turn your back on those who are already close.
They didn't want to be close.
So you see, they did. They didn't know that they could do it any other way, so they cheated their way in. But you see, they did. So Hashem says to Yoshua, you have a responsibility to go towards them. I like people who want to come close. They did it improperly. So what? You can't turn your back on them. So Yeshua goes and fights to protect them. Later on in Jewish history, there's King Saul is going to murder or have his chief of staff murder a city of Kohanim. And after that city of Kohanim dies, so the Givonim who were there as water drawers and woodcutters servicing that city where the altar was, so some of them die. And then later at the end of King David's reign, there's a famine. There's a drought, not a famine, there's a drought. And King David finally, after 3 years, he asks God, why is there a drought? And God says, because some of the Givonim died when King Saul murdered the Kohanim. So some of them were innocent victims of that. They lost their livelihood and some of them died. So King David calls in the Givonim and he says, God says, until you are appeased, there won't be rain. So tell me, what can we do to appease you? What money would you like? What gold, what silver, what political position would you like? And the Givonim say, no. You can't appease us. We lost our relatives. We want a life for a life. You have to kill members of King Saul's family. That's the only appeasement we'll have. And King David says, what do you mean? What do you gain by that? I'll pay you. I'll give you. What do you want? They say, no, we're not giving in. So David says to himself, okay, maybe publicly they don't want to give in. So he starts calling them in one by one. He says, look, no one's going to know. Let me just talk to you. What can I pay you? What can I offer you? How will you be appeased? God says, we have to appease you. And each one turns to David and says, no, what do you mean? A life for a life. We want people from King Saul's family. We want heads from his family. So King David doesn't have a choice. God says, whatever it takes to appease them, without that, I'm not bringing rain. So as much as he tries, they won't agree. So they draw lots, and a few members of King Saul's family are hung, and their bodies are left hanging all summer long. And tens of thousands of non-Jews heard of this. They said, why is it that the aristocracy's family, they were relatives of King David's too, how come they're left hanging there? Judaism doesn't let bodies stay hanging. How come they were killed? So they said, there were these converts who tricked their way in, and then they were slighted, and they were innocent bystanders who were killed, and the Jewish people had to atone for that. So these people were executed out of their honor. When that happened, tens of thousands of non-Jews converted to Judaism. They said, a religion that treats their gerim so fairly? But the flip side also happened. When King David saw that they were not willing to forgive, they were unrelenting, King David convened his court and made a declaration that the Givonim are no longer Jews. And we have halacha in Shulchan Aruch that a court can remove from a people their Jewish status. Even though ordinarily we say once a Jew, always a Jew, except King David said the Jewish people have three traits that every Jew must have. Baishanim, Rachmanim, Gomle Chasadim. They have shame, they have mercy, and they do kindness. These people didn't have mercy. These people, they weren't embarrassed from King David. They didn't have mercy. They weren't willing to do kindness with their fellow men. If they don't have mercy, if they don't have that pivotal trait that a Jew has to have, that proves that they're not a part of the people. And with that declaration, King David removed them from the people. They could no longer marry within us. So even though technically in what we're learning now, they became a part of the Jewish people, later on they proved that they were unworthy of that. So yes, we lost family members of the aristocracy of King Saul's family because God said, I'm not forgiving until they forgive. But even so, they lost from that deal. Yes?
Can born Jews be taken away then? What about
nowadays? Yeah. It's halacha in Shulchan Aruch.
Nowadays?
I don't know. If the Shulchan Aruch quotes it, so what can I say?
How can Hashem allow for innocent people to be killed?
That's a good question, which we will explore when we get there. It's a good question. It deserves...
It seems really bad. So like, no, I'm not giving you water until you kill innocent people.
Oh.
That's basically what...
Right? You're 100% right. So the question is very good. Either bring it up this Thursday night and we'll discuss it, or wait till we get there in the book of Shmuel and we'll discuss it there. Okay.
Cool. I thought God's forgiving.
What?
I thought he's a forgiving God. He's supposed to be merciful too.
So you have a good question, which deserves a good answer. I don't see in the time that's left that I could give the introductions necessary to answer it, to do it justice. So, Thursday night, Bezat Hashem. Okay. So now that the other kings have gathered to fight the people of Givon, so Yoshua goes and fights them. And Hashem tells him, don't worry. I'm making your life easier. I'm gathering the enemies. You'll be able to finish them off. And in the middle of the night, Yoshua attacks them. And he stuns them. And he chases them. And the Hashem has stones fall upon them from heaven. And it hails these big stones, and they're victorious. And then Yoshua sings his song. This war happened on a Friday afternoon, and Yoshua said to the sun, don't set, because we have to finish this war, and if Shabbos enters, so then technically we don't, it's not Pikuach Nefesh. So Yoshua didn't want it to set, and he tells the sun, you stop moving. And they continue for 36 hours, they continue their war, and then the sun sets. So that's an interesting point, that the sun setting is what makes the days shift. Meaning ordinarily, we'd say the sun is a sign of when the day begins and ends. But here, from this story, it would seem that the sun is the cause. If the sun doesn't set, then the day doesn't switch. So then if Ilan Ramon flies to the moon, and his sun never sets, so then maybe his day never shifts. Maybe he's on the same day. Then the question is, when he lands back on Earth, all of Earth is on a Tuesday, and he flew off on a Sunday. So then now he's still on Sunday? How does that work? So you say, no, he shifts to Tuesday. Why? The days didn't shift for him, right? If Yoshua could stop the sun and the days don't shift, does that mean the whole world's days didn't shift? Well, that's what it seems like. Okay, so obviously this needs work. But the simple reading is, it's a song. However we understand it.
Wait, so he stopped time?
That's the tradition we have. I mean, the words say, Vayidom HaShemesh V'yareach Hamad. The sun stood and the moon stood. Neither one advanced until we finished our war. Joshua said, don't you move! I got to finish my war. And that's the simple reading of the prophet. Some will say that it's a song. In a song, you could say the sun stopped. Meaning that's another way of saying we accomplished so much, the sun stopped. That would be a simple understanding of what's going on here. But the words say the sun stopped, and the sages seem to have understood it literally, that the sun stopped. Whatever that means. Yes? You wanted something?
He missed days of tefillin.
What?
He missed days of tefillin.
He didn't miss days. The days didn't advance.
Ilan Ramon.
Ilan Ramon. I hear. Fine. So, the five kings run away. They hide in a cave. Yoshua hears that they found the cave, so he says, okay, put huge stones at the entrance to the cave so they shouldn't escape, and set up guards, and then we have to continue giving chase. And so they finish destroying the enemy, and then they come back and they capture the five kings. They take the five kings out of the cave, the king of Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Eglon, and Yoshua calls the generals and he says, each of you should put your feet on their necks. And Yoshua said, don't be scared. You guys have to be strong. Just as you see now, you have them under your feet. This is how Hashem will allow you to conquer your enemies that you're fighting. And then Yoshua kills them and hangs them. And again, at nightfall, they are buried. And then we continue going through the wars, city after city, that we conquered. And there was okay, we go from one city to the next. I don't think we have to go through each one. Some of the kings unified and attacked us, and that was to make our life easier so that we could conquer them more quickly.
And did you totally conquer?
The total number was 31. That was the number of kings. So that's what the commentaries say, not over here, but on Torah, that in Israel the cities were of such importance that the head of each city was called a king, and they really led their own domain, meaning technically there were 31 kings where each one was considered their own territory.
They all had elaborate kingdoms, or just like little...
Well, you see that, 12,000 people in a kingdom.
Small, probably.
Okay, yeah. So right, they were small kingdoms,
small.
Right.
So, right. So Amisol just running around...
Well, they united, and they tried to attack us, and we allowed them. We said, you could stay and pay taxes. You don't have to fight us. God gave us this land. You have three choices. Stay around and keep the Noahide laws, be moral people, and pay taxes. Leave peacefully, or fight and die.
So
they chose to fight and die.
So were they considered bad?
Well, they made a bad choice. I don't know if they were evil. I mean, the Torah does say that God would not bring us into the land of Israel until they had sinned enough to deserve being kicked out. It says that in the book of Bereshit.
Can't criticize the colonists for taking over America. Same thing.
That deserves another discussion. Okay?
It's different. That's same. No, it's different.